I'm Mary Nightingale. Welcome to the Piper Podcast, where I talk to successful founders about how they built their brand legend, how they did it, where they are now, where they're going, where they want to be, and where they are on the 71770 journey. Number of employees, sites, turnover, whatever. These are the key inflection points which Piper believes indicate the need for step change. With me today are Howard and Vivian Wong, founders of the hugely successful brand that is Little Moons, the bite-sized balls of mochi ice cream that have become big news. Well, welcome to both of you. How nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Well, explain about Little Moons for the very few people who are out there who haven't actually tried them.
So what they actually are really super premium balls of ice cream, about the size of a golf ball, wrapped in a layer of Japanese rice dough called mochi, which basically enables ice cream to be eaten like a bite-sized treat. They taste fabulous.
And how did the idea come about?
Well, our parents had a bakery that made traditional mochi, which we grew up working in. And as we grew up and travelled, Howard tried it in the States and I tried it in Japan. And we just thought this would be such a brilliant product to bring to Europe.
And your parents came originally from Malaysia, is that right?
Yeah, they're both Malaysian Chinese. And I think across Asia, they have the similar rice dough in different countries under different names.
Explain exactly what mochi is.
So mochi is ground rice flour mixed into a dough, and it's steamed and pounded, and so it's quite special texture. It's quite chewy. I think it's called a Q texture, and it's quite unusual.
A Q texture. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a texture that we don't have in Europe, where it's a little bit chewy, and we don't have that texture really in a lot of foods here.
But the idea of combining mochi with ice cream hadn't been done before, had it?
It has been done in the States and it has been done in Japan as well, but it wasn't anything that we tried in Europe. So when we tried it, we just thought this is such a brilliant combination of textures. So when my parents used to make mochi combined with the red bean, which is the traditional mochi.
Like it's a dumpling-y
exactly,
looking
yeah.
thing.
When we shared that with friends, they would find it quite unusual because you'd have the unusual texture and then the unusual filling. However, when we tried it with ice cream, you have this slightly unusual texture, but the ice cream is so familiar. It goes really well together. And I think it means that people just love the two combined textures.
Is it kind of like Marmite? Do you kind of love it or hate it?
We actually embrace that because we've always thought we'd rather have people that were passionate fans of your product or really didn't like it rather than people who just thought, yeah, it's all right, it's not bad. But I think generations change and minds open up to different flavours and textures from the world. If you look at sushi, I think probably when it first came to the UK, probably like 90% of people probably didn't like it. And now it's got, you know, now it's a huge thing.
I think as people have travelled more and become more open to culture, like London is now the food centre of the world. You can get any cuisine anywhere. And so I think we've benefited from that.
Yeah, definitely. So what were you doing before you did Little Moons?
So I trained as a chartered accountant and then went to work in the city, although I like to say I've been clean for 13 years. but in the whilst we were doing all of that, we did always used to help our parents in the bakery in the summer holidays at school and every summer holiday and weekends. You know, if you're running your own business, as our parents were, you have to draw on every single resource and your children definitely are one of those. So we'd often be helping our parents all through before starting our businesses.
Very strong family units.
Very strong. And so I think that's why a lot of people ask, how can you work with your brother? But our family ties are incredibly strong. And I think that's definitely a reason, one of the reasons why we've worked so well together.
Were your parents ambitious for you? Did they push you hard?
I think they did. But in terms of wanting to go into the family business, they actually never put pressure on us to do that. In fact, they worked hard, they used to tell us, so that we could, you know, have the opportunities that they didn't have and that we wouldn't have to work that hard doing a family business. So there was never pressure to go into business. But then after a few years working in the city, I think my parents became more supportive of us, like pursuing our dreams.
I think they were really keen for us to do well academically, just so that it didn't close any doors. And so I think if you do well academically, it just means you can choose. It's easier to choose what you want to go into and what you want to do. But my mum always said to me, particularly as a woman, you've got to think about what career you have, because it is hard. And I think in the 70s, when she'd had me, employers were less understanding of the role that mothers play and the pressures on them. And so I think she found it quite hard to have children and continued working, which is why she ended up starting her own bakery. And so from a very young age, she said to me, you know, try and choose a job where it's easier to be a mum. And so I always could see that I wanted to start my own business. That was one of the reasons why. You just have more flexibility if you're running your own business.
Mm. And also, do you think that kind of entrepreneurial spirit is almost sort of bred into you?
I definitely think growing up in a family business kind of opens you up to the world of business at an early age, and that kind of gives you opportunities that some people might not have. But I also think that, you know, looking back, it was a really typical sort of Asian family unit. And I think the learnings from that, when we started the business, I can look at my parents' business and think, why didn't it grow bigger or more? And with a family unit, you tend to sort of keep things in the family. And I went to a business conference or an entrepreneurs conference really early on in the journey. And someone gave a speech sort of talking about how the most successful entrepreneurs tend to be the most trusting people. And the reason for that is that they tend to sort of put faith in their team and let them go about and go off and do things. And unless you have that trust in people, your business is never really going to grow if you're trying to do everything yourself. And I think that really impacted me and my mindset on how to grow Little Moons when we set up building our business, because their business was a really small one that was really stable over time, whereas we were always looking to grow, fast.
And I think what was really helpful was going to work in wider business so you could see the business processes and systems and how a best-in-class business ran. And I learned a lot from that.
Mm. Were you both in the city?
Yes.
Both. How much of a risk did you feel you were taking when you both gave up these very, highly paid, stable, interesting, aspirational jobs and you decided, no, we're going to step away?
Well, we didn't do it exactly the same time. We talked about it, and I left at first because I was the older one, and just started the business, started curating. I worked with my dad on the recipe together, and it took a while for us to get that together. I mean, Howard was always involved at the weekends as well, but that's what I did for the first 2 years. We refined the recipe, and I started getting our first clients in. And when we first got, Yo Sushi was a huge client for us. We won them quite early on, and a few of the other restaurants. It looked like it was going to be a business that was going to work. And so after that, Howard joined the business because there was, it wasn't able to support both of us at the beginning. So it was just a step-by-step process, but it was definitely a leap of faith. And I think one of the catalysts for me was my dad was first diagnosed in 2004 with cancer. And that was really a seminal moment for me because you just realise how short life is. So you either decide to do something and you've got to go for it. Otherwise, you can't wait forever. So that was definitely something that made me realise, if you want to do something, do it now.
Mm, and you had that time working with your dad and developing the product. He must have been so proud of you.
I hope so. I think he would. I know he looks down on us every day and he would be really proud to see where we've taken Little Moons. But yeah, that was definitely a seminal moment that made us decide.
And he passed away?
He passed away in 2018. So although he was diagnosed in 2004, he then went through treatment and he was in remission for 10 years and then it came back. So I think it was lymphoma, so it was quite a slow-growing cancer.
Mm. But as you say, you've done this amazing thing and he would be so proud. Piper talks about building brand legends, and at the heart of this is the real importance for brands to stay resolutely true to their purpose. What would you say Little Moon's purpose is?
We didn't set out with an intentional purpose. We just wanted to create the best tasting mochi ice cream, and we knew that we wanted to elevate it and bring it to as many people as possible. But as we've worked on our brand purpose, we've defined it as bringing little lifts that spark positivity. And the reason for that is, when you make ice cream, you're ultimately in the business of bringing joy to people. It's a really joyful product. But what makes Little Moons really unique, when we really asked ourselves, what's it bringing to our consumers? We kept getting this term used, which was, it just gives me a little lift.
Yeah.
And I think that's really unique to our product because of the size format. You can sort of have one before bed and you don't feel too guilty about it. And we're a really positive brand. We've always set out to be really joyful and colourful. And I think that's what it gives to people. It makes them sort of uniquely happy. So that's what our purpose is.
I'm sure I'm not the only founder. I always read the reviews that are left on, say, Ocado. And I read this one woman and she gave us 5 out of 5. And she said, after a very stressful week at work, a cuppa and two of these made life meaningful again. And when you hear people write about your product like that, it resonates with me as well. Because when we're so busy, sometimes you just sit down, you need a cup of tea and a Little Moons and you're just like, right, I'm reset. I can do this. And it's all about bringing a small moment of joy.
It's a wonderful thing to be involved with in that way, isn't it? You know, you're not making something worthy. You're doing something that is luxurious and a treat, isn't it?
Yeah. I often remind myself at work that we do only just make ice cream. So when everything becomes a little bit overwhelming, we're not like curing cancer. We are just making ice cream. We do bring joy to the world.
And the food market's incredibly competitive, isn't it? So what would you say makes Little Moons better and different?
I think it all starts with the product. When you create food, it's all about creating something delicious, and you can have the best marketing in the world, but if the product doesn't deliver, you're not going to be around for long. And I think, you know, our parents have been making it for 20 years, and we started off supplying restaurants, so we have a real focus on the product from day one, and we built the foundations supplying some of the best restaurants around the world. And I think that's the crucial fundamental thing that makes us different. We often worry about, we call it a race to the shelf. Like, our strategy for the last few years has always been about getting there first. And that's not just for commercial reasons. It's also, if people eat a bad mochi ice cream, and they do exist, people like are turned off the product forever, because they just say, okay, I don't like that whole category of food, I'm not going to try another one. So we want people's first experience of mochi ice cream to be a Little Moons, because we are confident in like the product we make. Other brands have come up, and they tend to be mochi ice cream brands which are a bolt-on to another ice cream company that makes private label for, you know, lots of other supermarkets, and it's just like a side consideration for them. So they can't give the product the focus that we do.
And I think when we started, we didn't really think about profit margins, and we weren't constrained by a formula, which I think a lot of companies are, and we just sourced the best ingredients that we could. And I think that's really made a difference to our product as well, because if you look at our ingredients list, there's a lot of natural product in there as opposed to just flavourings.
And you do vegan options as well, don't you? How important is that whole kind of vegetarian vegan movement, the move towards health?
I think, you know, we're actually the... I had a statistic the other day that we're the biggest vegan ice cream brand in the UK. So we sell more vegan ice cream than, you know, Magnum or Ben & Jerry's. But we never set out to be a vegan brand. When we produce vegan flavours, we only produce them if they taste as good as dairy products. I think we don't market it as explicitly our vegan range. They're just part of our usual range, but they happen to be vegan. So I think it's really important to us, but it's not core to what we do.
How did the product then develop over time?
I think we are led in a different way than other businesses. Like, we don't do the market research and see what the consumers want to give. We decide what tastes the best and then launch it. And then our consumers seem to have loved it.
Mm. How many flavours do you have now?
We have about 15 flavours now.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about this journey from being food services to the consumer brand. How did that happen naturally, or was it something that you drove?
We've actually always wanted to be in supermarkets, but when we started off, we didn't really have the money to sort of do the branding and marketing. And it also wasn't the right time in the market. Like, getting onto the shelves is one thing, but then actually selling off the shelf is another thing. And I don't think 12 years ago, when we started the business, the market was ready for it. So we actually talked about it. We thought, actually, selling to restaurants made a lot of sense, because that's where consumers discover new products. They have a more adventurous mindset. You have a way to sort of maybe introduce the product and tell you a little bit about what it was. And it was a way to make money before you'd like completed the branding exercise. So it was quite an intentional thing that we decided to do as a strategy.
How long were you only in restaurants, and when did you make that breakthrough to supermarkets?
We started in 2010 selling to restaurants, and in 2015 was when we got our first retail listing with Whole Foods.
And exciting moment, I imagine that was, wasn't it? A moment of big change.
Absolutely huge. So we'd been talking to a lot of people in the industry, and we said, well, this is where we want to launch our brand. We thought Whole Foods Market was the best place to do so. And everyone said, good, you know, Whole Foods is not going to write back to you. It can take you a year or maybe 2 years to even get on their radar. And so we thought, we'll give it a go. And we emailed their buyer, not expecting to hear back from him. And 20 minutes later, we got an email back from him. And he said, you had me at Mochi. And we met with them immediately. And we became their best-selling ice cream for, I think, the next two and a half years.
I remember they did a big promotion where they were giving away Little Moons. And, you know, they obviously went for it, absolutely 100%. They were enthusiastic from the start.
Yeah, they were super supportive. They gave us a lot of shelf space. We had this new concept of pick and mix freezers, which they supported wholeheartedly, and we had those in all of their stores. And it was just a really a great way to sample the product. People could just buy one flavour if they wanted to try it, or they could buy a mix of 12. So it worked really well for our brand build.
So then you went to Ocado?
We went to Ocado, then Waitrose, and then Tesco's.
Wow. And at that point, everything changes. What was the impact in terms of your production and all of that?
I think up until that point, we'd been growing quite stably, but we were struggling to get into further retailers, actually. We hit a bit of a plateau where people saw our success in high-end retailers, and then they thought, said, but, you know, are you quite a London product? You know, are you hitting a certain demographic, and is this going to work nationally? But we're having lots of success growing internationally and growing. So we're already one of the top 10 fastest growing food brands. But then I think we blew up on TikTok over the sort of lockdown period, and things just went totally insane. So we went from £9 million turnover to 27 in the space of 12 months. And I think, and that's when we got Sainsbury's and all the other supermarkets, kind of in 1 year. And that was a year of just the biggest change, like immense. And I think sometimes I hear you talk about, you know, the Piper 7, 17 and 17.
Yeah, yeah.
We blew through sort of 7 to 17 in the space of a year.
Do you mean, how on earth do you deal with that?
Well, I probably didn't sleep one single night. It was really difficult because it was right in the middle of COVID. We had already limited the amount of people that could work on our production floor because we had to space them out. Supply chain across the world was really difficult. We couldn't buy more machines because no one was manufacturing them. There was a cardboard shortage. There were no containers coming from Asia. So it was a real mix period of everything coming together and making it really difficult to grow the business. So our teams really got behind us, and we changed our shift patterns from 2 to almost 24 hours, 7 days a week. And we had the support of the team to do that. And then we also brought in some experts to help us scale our factory that really quickly.
Who are your team? Have you had some people who've been with you right from the start?
Yeah, so we've had people work for us, you know, from the very beginning, who know the recipe as well as we do and have worked with our dad. And as the team has grown, we've brought on more and more experts to help us with, you know, factory development, factory design, how to manufacture more efficiently, as well as marketing and sales and finance. We've had to bring on so many people to help us on this journey.
You're listening to the Piper podcast, How I Grew My Brand. Today, I'm with Vivian and Howard Wong, founders of the mochi ice cream brand, Little Moons. Tell me more about TikTok, because this complete explosion where you had something like a 2,000% increase in turnover because of TikTok. I'm an old git, right? Explain to me, what does that even mean?
So we had about 500 million views of videos that had been hashtag Little Moons in the space of about 6 months. And I think that's just an unbelievable amount of attention to get for a brand. It's like the dream come true for any brand. But the truth is, it's not something that you can plan for, and it's not something that we actually created by design. It's one of those magical moments in time where you just happen to sort of hit the zeitgeist. It was like we're in the middle of lockdown. All people could do was go to supermarkets, and we happened to be a new food that people were discovering at that time. And then when you watch a video of someone eating something and finding it delicious, and then you see one video of someone saying, oh, actually, I'm not so sure about this, I don't like it, you really just want to try it. And I think it was a video that was really easy to film and make yourself, so kids could, like, you know, take part of it, parents could take part in it. And it was kind of like a treasure hunt at the time.
We'd have people phoning the office, like a dad would say, look, I'm from Wales. I've been to 8 different Tescos. They're all sold out. My kids have told me not to come home unless I have a pack. At this point, I'm ready to drive to London to your factory to pick some up. We'd go into a Waitrose. You could just see, like, you know, a middle-aged man just wandering through the frozen aisle looking completely lost. And I went up to him and I said, are you looking for Little Moons? He was like, yes, how did you know? And I said, oh,
I
you know.
I could tell.
So we took him to the shelf, which was empty, and he looked distraught. But it was so incredible to have so many people looking for your product. And we also have, well, we call it a pop-up, but we've been there for many years now in Selfridges. And in the middle of lockdown, there were like queues of people all the way down and round the corner to Oxford Street queuing for hours for our product. It was just such an incredible moment to see.
How does it actually work? Are you able to see where it was generated from?
You can't actually see what the first video was, but there were a few of the earlier videos that we could identify. Where you see it come through is Tesco's calling you up saying, there's no product on shelf and there's no product in our warehouses. Can you get some to us immediately? And where the rate of sale is usually, say, I don't know, 7 or 8 a week per store, they were over 100. We couldn't actually match it because we couldn't supply them fast enough. And you get that fed back through the retailers. And I guess that's how you feel it as a business.
Well, unbelievably exciting. I mean, here's you. You'd had a very sound business from 2010. It had been going very well. It was steady. It was, I'm guessing, profitable, you know, all good. And then the pandemic happens. How did that feel? Exciting, thrilling, terrifying?
It was such a roller coaster journey. So in January 2020, we just moved into a larger factory, which Howard and I had hotly debated, should we invest this? Because it's a huge investment in the business. It could, you know, if we didn't do well, we couldn't pay for the rent. So 2 months later, in March 2020, COVID hits, we shut the factory. We don't know if we're going to have any income coming in. All the restaurant business is gone. When is this going to come back to normal? So you cash flow plan. And I just thought, look, by October, it'll be absolutely fine. We've got enough money to take us down through to October. And then in October, the second lockdown hits. And so you're just constantly scrambling to try and figure out how to keep your team safe, how to make sure the guys that can work at home feel part of the business, how everyone who is coming to work, the production staff, are able to supply. And thankfully, the groceries did stay open so we could supply them.
But in the early days, people didn't even know that.
No, we didn't know. And so that's why we made the decision to shut the factory, just to make sure that everyone was safe, because you didn't know how it was passed at that time. And then December 2020, I believe, was when Brexit happened. And that was the moment where the trade licenses have to come through and things. And so we had to navigate through that as well. So in December, we sent all of our stock to Europe because we knew it was going to be really difficult to export products out there. So our warehouse was completely empty. Because January, February, March is a quiet time for ice cream, we were going to rebuild up our stocks over those couple of months. So January 21, when we went viral on TikTok, we were coming from an empty warehouse. So it was really hard to meet demand.
Yeah, it's like our core consumer typically weren't TikTok users. You know, typically our consumer was like late 20s to 30s and above. And there's a whole world outside of TikTok that would have no idea what's going on. So we thought, okay, we need to leverage this moment and try and, you know, get it into other media formats to cover it, to cover the TikTok craze, basically.
It's a great story, isn't it?
We worked really hard to sort of get the wider world to hear about it. And then I guess that's when the hard work began. Initially, we were just like, this is amazing. Like, look at all these videos. Everyone was at home at the time, right? So you're like scrolling through this on your sofa. It doesn't quite feel real. I think when we went down to Selfridges and saw actual people queuing down the street, you know, we brought down our mum because we were like, this is a once in a lifetime moment where supermarkets are knocking on your door asking to get listed. But you had loads of problems to face. Like, you can't supply everyone. So do you turn people away? Do you stop supplying your like most loyal customers that have been with you for 10 years because you're prioritizing new supermarkets? So you had to navigate this whole world of like, okay, how do we manage this? And what can we produce, not knowing, you know, what stock can come in, the supply chain. It was just a super tough year. And Viv had one of the toughest years of her life, I think, because Viv, you know, I joked early on in the journey. I said, I'm sales and marketing. My job is done for the year. Over to you, Viv.
Yeah, so we had to basically build the factory up to many different lines. We went from, I think, 100 people working in the factory to 400. And it was just so hard to put those processes in place. We didn't have the systems to run a business that size. So it put a lot of pressure on supply chain, HR, also everything of the culture, which got massively diluted. Because how do you engage culture when so many people are coming through the front door?
You said you didn't sleep, but in all 24 of those waking hours, you must have been battling this. So how did you do it?
So like I said, we pulled on our team and no one knows how to do this. And I think if you're going to be an entrepreneur, it's about problem solving every single day. And this is I think I'm quite good at it. So for HR, for example, you just have to try and put some processes in place, and it's not perfect, and there were many where there were lots of things that did wrong, but you just continue trying to learn and just improve.
What sort of things did you do wrong?
How do you train that many people? We didn't have training records, we didn't have a training plan, because you know the odd person would join and then they would have a week to work with someone else who would have the time to teach them, this is how you put the machinery together, this is how you make the ice cream, this is our recipe. But when you have that many people in, you have to have a full-on training academy, like systems. We didn't have a trainer like that. You can't have people making the product to the quality that you're expecting and training 10 people. And everyone cared so much that our team worked overtime, and we really overstretched everyone to make sure that the quality of product going out didn't decrease. There was absolutely no magic wand to come up with a solution. We just brought on more and more people. The guys that have worked there for many years just continued monitoring and training everyone, and it was just a labour of love and caring and just the dedication of our existing team. That's all I can really put it down to.
When we talk about inflection points in the business, there are two massive ones for us. One was bringing in a non-exec director to help us in our journey. And that we did that quite early on in our journey. And
How early on? When would that have been?
I think it was 2016. So 6 years on from our journey, he joined us.
And just having someone on board who's sort of been through it before and can kind of call on his black book of experts when times like this happen was, you know, really helpful to get through it. So when that happened, he knew an amazing ops guy who could bring in and just do a SWAT team to help us get through it. And that's so critical. You know, we would have been like rabbits with headlights coming towards us without bringing in great people. And the other inflection point was just when we made the decision to invest in our senior leadership team. We had confidence in the business. We'd built really great foundations, but we'd got traction in some supermarkets, and it was really about just like making it grow from that point. And I remember our NED saying, like, the time is right to invest in a senior leadership team. And we were looking for everything, marketing, sales director, ops director, finance director, all at once. And the NED was so important because, you know, he was like, this is the level you need. Don't pay less and have, you know, not the right experience to bring you to where you need to go. And don't pay too much because then they won't be too interested in a business of your size. And that was so important because when times like that did hit, you had like a really, really good team to help you get through it.
It's so difficult to imagine how the size of that challenge, because it's not like you were making widgets and you could pile them high in a warehouse. It's something that has a lifespan. It has to be kept at a certain temperature. It's a fragile product, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And supply chain is absolutely key with that. But we are lucky that we have 18-month shelf life on the product and we're not doing a fresh product.
So I take you back to these inflection points. And you know, the Piper idea is 7-17-70. You in 2020, you were around 7, and then you powered straight through to where are you now, would you say?
I think our last financial accounts shut around 50 million. And so that was, I guess, from 10 to 50 million in 2 years. And that's where we're at now.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's mind-boggling.
But I'm always thinking about, well, how do we maintain it? What are we doing? And we're growing the business globally. And so we've just recently launched in Australia, which is doing incredibly well. And so that's where my focus is. That's my next point that we're aiming for.
We're now just really excited to go on to the next thing because the opportunity keeps growing and there's like, you know, things to do, new products to launch, new regions to go into. And so I'm just excited to have the opportunity to build like such a great team. We now have new investors on board. And just looking to the future, really. Mm. I think it never stops.
So you have got investors now. And talk to me about that process. And how did you choose? How did it work?
Well, we're actually quite rare in that we were self-funded for the first pretty much 12 years of our business. And we always used to say to each other, like, we wouldn't get external financing unless we thought the lack of it was really holding the business back. But post TikTok, we just thought there's a massive opportunity out there. As I said, it's a race to the shelf. That was our mantra, and we needed the funding to do it. So when we set about looking for investors, it was a really intense process. Went on for about 6 months, talked to a lot of different people, and in the end we ended up picking, and they picked us, I guess, a private equity firm who specialise in consumer brands. And it was really clear from the beginning that they really understood brands, they understood our values, and Yeah.
We've been with them almost a year now. And in terms of building our new factory, they've pulled on their contacts to help with experts. And it's been great having them on the board. They also brought in our CEO, who is wonderful. And they've been an absolute build on the team that we have.
I want to talk to you about the family unit. Since 2010, it started off just with you, Vivian, and then the two of you were working together. So you were this very tight partnership. How did that work?
I think it was really lovely in the very beginning because it was so simple. It was just Howard and I in the office with our team of 12 helping to make mochi downstairs. And if we did branding, we'd do it together. We'd sit in the office and we'd sort of help each other out. We wore many hats. And then I guess as the business grew, we had to split our roles out because then, you know, we had to have clear responsibilities. And I think we did struggle with that.
Yeah, because I think when you're wearing many hats and, you know, we didn't set out saying, OK, this is your defined role and this is your defined role. So we did all the things that we wanted to do and we found fun. And there was obviously bits that neither of us wanted to do.
Like engineering is really hard to find an engineer to come out for a very small business with one machine, you know, an ad hoc.
Yeah.
And so who wants to be the one to come in at 6 a.m. because the team's arrived and the packing machine hasn't switched on?
Yeah.
Like, so I'll be like, you do it. No, you do it. Like,
oh, so yes. You were sharing a flat at this point as
yeah.
well, were
yeah.
you? I mean, this is
yeah.
intense, right?
It is,
it's intense.
It is really intense. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. We were trying to save money. But what would happen is we'd talk about work so much. And actually, I love talking about work and ideas all the time. And it's too much for, you know, you'd get home and you just think, actually, I just want to go to my room now and not continue talking about business. So there were tough times. I think the early years were some of the hardest, but also some of the most fun memories you have. Like every single win was so massive back then. Like the first time you'd get into a restaurant, you know, we'd both be like so excited, we'd go down there and sit there eating dinner, like trying to see, like, is this going to work in a restaurant? Like, and seeing someone order it and then watching them eating it and then like having really great reactions and taking photos of it was like really magical memories for us. And first time getting to Whole Foods and our first international trade fair, you know, feels like a blur, but...
But I think if you're going to grow a business together, you're obviously going to have arguments and falling out, but you can never stop being brother and sister. And I think that's been really great during the tough times. But we did a personality test and it came out with we're both polar opposites in personalities. So Howard's like blue-red and I'm like yellow-green type thing.
And what does that mean exactly?
So Howard's very results-orientated.
Yeah. More analytical and ideas-driven, I guess.
Whereas I was very much a doer. I'm kind of team-related, like quite touchy-feely about like people. But what came out of that test was how you work with people that are the complete opposites of you. So, for example, if I'm sat there entering every single invoice onto Sage, because I was the head of finance back then as well, and Howard would want to discuss a big strategic decision with me, I just wouldn't be in the right place. And I'd say to him, I can't talk to you right now about this because I'm focusing on this. And then he'd say to me, what's so important that you're doing that you can't have this discussion with me? And so I think he just thought I was being annoying, irritating sister. And so when we got the manual on how you handle this type of person, he read that I need to be given space and I need to be given some time to think about these things. So what he should do is say, hey, I want to talk to you about this particular strategic direction I've been thinking about. Have you got time next Wednesday at 3 o'clock to discuss it? Then I could do my homework and have my thoughts about it. And then I'd be ready to have this debate with him or discuss it with him. And so I think then he understood.
Yeah, it's definitely evolved as you brought more people into the business as well. You can kind of like separate your roles better and learn to work with each other better. And we don't live together anymore. So that's obviously a helpful thing.
Yeah. But I wonder, you know, having started from this very tight team of the two of you, has it been in any sense difficult to let go or to allow others in to this very tight family team?
I don't think it has. A lot of people have asked me that and I haven't found it difficult at all. We always say we bring on smarter people than us. So you've got to bring them in and let them flourish and let them thrive. Because if you're constantly on top of them, why would you bring them in the first place if you're then going to tell them how to do something?
Of course, logically, that makes sense. But you're the founders and this is your baby. And I just wonder in reality how difficult it is to do that logical, sensible thing.
Yeah, I mean, big picture wise, I actually feel like it's amazing. Like the first time you think you see something being done and it has no involvement with you and it's been done to this incredible level by your team, It's such a magical feeling. Like sometimes we say, you know, we're back in the day, we'd be out there literally building stands by ourselves, right? And not very well. And you see your team sort of like create these amazing events or amazing marketing campaigns. And, you know, of course, in the early days, when you've been so used to doing everything yourself, making every decision, you can be quite micromanaging. So when you bring people in and, you know, there'll be moments where someone has a different creative idea to you, it's a real challenge. People are nervous about joining founder-led businesses because they feel that they might not have the autonomy to impose themselves. And so I used to talk to my Ned a lot about, you know, where's the right line and which battles do I pick? And it really is about thinking about, you know, when do you think you're right, or when's it best to just let people get on with it? So it's not been easy.
And I think as your business grows, you have to grow as people as well. You have to change as people. And I've had an executive coach for many years now just to make sure that I'm the right manager or I show the right level of leadership as we brought on senior leaders to the business.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unusual, is it, for founders to exit the business because... guess what? They're great at founding things. They're great at starting stuff and driving stuff. They may not be that great at actually running it or scaling it.
Mm. Right. Absolutely. And the skills that got us to where we are today may not be the skills that we get. So that's why you've got to continually see what value you add to the business. And I feel like Howard and I still have value to add despite having an excellent CEO on board. So I think we work really well together as a team of three.
Talk to me more about taking your brand international, because you're going into Australia, and what is the plan? I mean, do you eventually go into Japan as well? Would that be the ultimate?
That'd be dream, selling ice to the Eskimos.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
We've actually always been really internationally focused. So, you know, one of our first trade shows we did was Anuga in Germany. But what is our strategy? So we talk about international markets rather than export markets, and it's sort of a mindset thing, right? You're not just shipping stuff abroad; you're building an international market. And we sort of separate them between key strategic ones, where we're actually building a team or potentially see it as a place where we would build our own team on the ground. And then we have other markets where it's more about working with distributors and supporting them with marketing. And so we kind of separate them, and they're always fighting for attention. Mm. You know, there's always a balance between going over after too many markets and you know, not putting enough focus into your key ones. But we've just launched into Australia, which is going super, super well. I think we're the best ice cream launch that they've had there in years, but don't want to brag. but they basically, sometimes I look at Australia and I think, why didn't we hit it earlier? It just makes total sense. You know, the Anglosphere, they eat three times as much ice cream as the average Brit, and it's quite a foodie culture, and they're quite used to sort of an Asian influence being in Australia. So it's going super well for us.
Do you run everything from the UK?
We do all the creative out of the UK, but in the last year, we've hired a marketing team in France and in Germany. We don't have a team in Australia yet, but mm-hmm. I think Australia, like, for example, we sell in Woolworths over there, and they've recently become bigger for us than Tesco, for example, which is an incredible thing. So we've been out there. We've been on, like...
You've been to Bondi Beach, yeah?
Yeah, you know, handing out mochi on the...
Really?
In a truck and stuff like that.
And how did it go? Was it well received?
Yeah, I think we always try and do fun activations like we've done in the UK. So we're just trying to replicate those in international markets. And I'm going out to Australia again in March.
And what about the US?
The US has always been this thing that we thought about. It's a classic, like, oh, it's such a big market. It'd be so amazing to go in there. But at the same time, it takes a lot of investment. It's a really complex market. It's not just a monolith. It's like every single state and region is different. So it's something we've ummed and ahed about and we're still thinking about. But it's something we're considering, but not yet.
Okay. Yeah. Sustainability is really important to Piper. It's a B Corp and sustainability is really key. How do you think about sustainability at Little Moons? Is it part of your thinking?
Yeah, we're actually on our B Corp journey ourselves.
We came to a Piper workshop actually on sustainability and packaging, and they introduced us to many sort of packaging suppliers who were on the cutting edge of new technology.
I think what's great about B Corp is that it gives you a structure with which to look at sustainability. So before, it's just kind of like, what do we think is important and what are the things we focus on? But B Corp's actually a well thought out program where you're kind of given guidance about the different buckets of impact that your business can make. And so by even going through the questionnaire made us think about things that we hadn't even thought about before. And so we're using that as kind of a toolkit with which to pursue our sustainability goals.
When I've mentioned to people about Little Moons, they're like, oh, Little Moons, I'm obsessed. And there does seem to be an unusually strong community of fans, super fans, and frankly, obsessives out there. Who are the Little Moon's customers?
Amazing people. I think it's changed through the years. So when we first launched, we were primarily in high-end retailers and restaurants. And I guess we used to talk about our consumer as being mavens, like people that love to go out and seek new things and sort of be the first to show off to their friends that they'd discovered, you know, this product first, or people that had traveled and tried us abroad. But over the years, obviously our demographic has changed and broadened through the years. It's like much more nationally distributed and moved a bit younger, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. But like you said, I think people like talking about Little Moons and telling people about them and the storytelling behind it, because they like to explain, you know, you have to wait 5 minutes, and, you know, that anticipation.
Or, oh, you have to wait 5 minutes,
yeah,
do you?
Yeah, so after you take it out the freezer, you've got to wait 5 minutes so that it gets the right texture. And then people like to explain, some people like it softer, so they leave it out for 10 minutes. A lot of people like to advocate Little Moons and tell our story. And I think that spread through word of mouth. And it's the best way to do it if you've heard about it through a friend as opposed to advertising or an influencer. And I think that's really how our community like talking about Little Moons, and that's how it's really spread. Mm. I think the challenge was building a category from scratch. So having to explain to so many people what mochi is. I've had to explain it's a soft, sweet dough every day for about 11 years of my life. And so, you know, I guess that comes with its challenges, but it's also, I guess, our source of strength that we were building something completely new. But that's also part of our magic.
Do you work with influencers?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah?
Quite a lot, yeah. We tend to work with micro-influencers and people that are genuinely passionate about Little Moons. Like, it's really rare for us to pay someone to cover us. And we're really fortunate to have like this really loyal fan base that kind of are happy to support us.
I think we're a company that is an example of how social media can really change the course of how a business goes.
So here you are with this massive success that you have created. What do you put your success down to?
I've thought about this a lot, actually. And I think that whilst we've worked really hard, you know, on the business as everyone does, and we've got a great brand, as many people have, and we have a really good product, and Little Moons is just a recipe of all those things put together. I think there has to be an element of luck with timing to make a company a success.
How much do you think is down to luck and timing, Howard?
I think luck and timing plays a huge part, but I think that a huge amount is also you kind of make your own luck. And there have been so many moments in our journey where we could have taken different decisions. And looking back, I think, you know, we've made some right decisions here. There's some calls we could have made massively wrong. And I think by and large, we've navigated it quite well. But so much of it is down to luck and timing. And also, we're born into a family that kind of made mochi. I mean, that's not down to us. We just happen to sort of be in that situation.
Yeah, and you've got to make the most of, say, the luck. So a lot of people say you were so lucky to have gone viral on TikTok, because it's not anything that you can manufacture. But then I guess where our skill was to turn that into long-term success.
What does success mean to you?
God, I guess looking back, for me, being successful means that I'm able to live my life the way that I want. And what I mean by that is I have time for my family, which is really important to me. And I do work, which I find incredibly fulfilling. I'm lucky enough to go to work with people that I really enjoy spending the day with. And, you know, I think I feel successful because I feel a great sense of happiness and fulfillment in my life. That's what success is to me.
Mm. Are you able to properly enjoy it? Because you described, you know, the year where you hardly slept and so on. I mean, have you managed to make a better sense of balance and perspective, do you think?
Yes. So this year, I've definitely decided to be more intentional with my time because I've, like I mentioned before, my dad's illness really put things in perspective, especially with time. And time is short. So use the time that you have left in a meaningful, fulfilling way. And I lost that in the last 2 years of absolute nuts. But I think it's fine if there's an end in sight. But now that's over, I do feel like it's personally, you know, broken me. And so I'm refocusing on my health. I'm refocusing on time with my husband, time with my family, time with my friends, all these things that you lost when you had to focus on work. And I think during your life, there's always going to be time where you've got to maybe focus on your kids, we were talking about earlier, or different elements of that are pulling your attention. But as long as you recenter and remember the important things in life, which is friends, family to me.
Howard, what do you think?
Success for me is about creating a company that you're like proud of, but the excitement comes from, you know, a constant state of improvement. So going on this B Corp journey, improving our processes and, you know, the benefits we give to our team. And I just see further sort of improvements in the company as being successful. And on a personal level, I do think it's been a crazy ride, and different times you prioritize the business over yourself. But I feel successful in that, for, you know, I'm able to balance my personal life, my health and the company. And I feel like in a good place right now. So that's success to me.
Has having made money changed your perspective?
I think it's nice to not have to worry about bills, but we've never been led by financial success. I think we've always run the business that way. We've always reinvested every single penny back into the business. We've not paid ourselves very much money at all when we could have.
I've always felt like I've had enough, even in the early stages of the business. And I've always kind of known that material or financial success is such a small determinant to like how happy you are. So even before, you know, we had a deal coming and we're about to get quite a lot of money, and I kind of already knew it wouldn't make that much impact on my life. And so as it's happened, it's been a year now, and I think if you ask any of my friends, like, I haven't changed, my lifestyle hasn't really changed, actually, to be honest, in any like meaningful way. Like, you might drive a nicer car, but that means nothing.
What's it enabled you to do? I mean, do you, for example, you know, how do you feel about philanthropy? Is that high on your list of priorities? And what interests you in that area?
I think having the freedom to dream and the time to think about that now. So I have more time now to give back to the Prince's Trust, which is a charity I've supported for many years. But I didn't have the time to go and see and mentor some of the young people that they help. So now I have, you know, luxury of time.
Right?
Yeah, the luxury of time. And now we've brought on more people in the business. I have the luxury to focus on the culture and values of the business rather than running the day-to-day firefighting. And that's, to me, you know, the luxury of having investors in and being able to add that element of time and thought to that process. I strongly support women in businesses because I think it's a real way that you can change your life, particularly with the Prince's Trust. You've got the Women Supporting Women initiative, and women were more impacted by COVID than men were, because they had to do the childcare at home. And I think if you start your own business, you are captain of your own ship. You can work after you put the kids to bed. You don't have to put any FaceTime in. The fruits of your labour are there for you to see, and you don't have to prove that to anyone else. And so that's something that I've really had more time to think about and support. And I'm also a great supporter of the Buy Women Built initiative, which also champion other women who have owned businesses and other entrepreneurs. And I think if we pull together, then it's a real source of strength to help each other grow businesses. And that's something that I've really enjoyed having more time to, you know, to help with.
Mm-hmm.
What about you?
For me, the biggest thing has been having the time to think about things, because the last 2 years have been so crazy. You've got all your attention is in the business. And so as sort of a British Chinese person growing up and didn't have many role models in business, I'm really keen to support kind of the Southeast Asian community. And so giving back time to talk and give speeches and things like that has been my initial route. I don't think I've got worked out a long-term philanthropic plan, but it's exciting to be able to start thinking about that.
Well, I was going to, that was something I wanted to talk to you more about. You know, how important is your heritage to you? You say there are very few role models in terms of being British Chinese, for example. I mean, is that something that, yeah, how important is that, do you think?
I think it shaped me quite a lot through my life. Growing up in London really helped, because we weren't, you know, I've read about other Asian people growing up in a small village. They were the only Chinese people here. In London, it's always been so international. I've always felt part of a Chinese community. We met with other Chinese kids, like in Chinese school on Sundays. And so, and you know, our food and our heritage, like, I haven't felt that different. And I've been quite proud to bring that to the wider community. So mochi is so unusual, and we've, you know, made it more widely available. It's now recognised more as a product.
It's kind of mainstream
and
now,
it's
isn't
now
it?
Mainstream. Yeah. And that's something that I've been really proud of.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're a kid, I remember, you know, my parents being like, why don't you bring some red bean mochi to your friends? They'll love it. And you'll be like, well, I think they're going to take the piss out of me if I show them this food, if I'm being honest. And kind of, I think a lot of people in the kind of Asian community share that kind of childhood experience of people kind of making fun of your food. So for us, it's a real source of pride that we've managed to take something that was initially so alien to sort of Western culture. And a lot of people when we started thought, do you really think this will work in the UK? Like, are you crazy, basically? And so I think within the Asian community, Little Moons is a bit of a source of pride that we've managed to take something from kind of our heritage and made it quite an aspirational thing to like. And so it's important to us. It's not like, you know, the biggest thing in my life or anything like that, but I'm kind of quite proud of that.
Yeah. And what about your, I mean, as we've discussed, very sadly, your dad passed away, but your mum, what does it mean to her, do you think, the two of you have achieved this extraordinary success?
I think that basically what it means for her is that she doesn't have to worry about us anymore. You know, now she can chill out and, you know, Viv and Howard are fine. They've got it covered. And I think in Asian parenting, a bit of a cliche is not to show too much pride, or what's the word? Like,
so you don't want to tell your kids you're too proud, and you don't, you know, you don't compliment your kids too much because you don't want them to be big-headed. So, but now, you know, I think she has told us that she is proud, which is huge if you have Asian parents. You know. But I guess that's, again, like we talk about the beauty of time. So we have time to spend with our parents because they're not going to be around forever. And so just to make sure that you do, you have the time to take care of them. Everyone wants to be able to take care of their parents, but whether you have the time to do so is another thing.
It's really interesting to look at the two of you sitting side by side there. You are obviously so close, and you look at Howard and Howard looks at you, Viv, and you finish each other's sentences. I mean, to have that degree of understanding is a fantastic thing with two founders, isn't it?
We do have really different skill sets, and also we have different ways of looking at things.
It does sound strange, like it's quite opposing views. Like, one of them was, do we open a bigger factory or not? And it's the different risk profile. And that was quite a big discussion between us. And how did we resolve that without an argument? I think, I don't know, we debated it hotly, and we ultimately went with the decision to open the larger factory, which thank God we did.
Who's more risk averse out of the... I'm going to guess. You're risk averse, are you, Howard?
I'm more risk averse, yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, go for it. We'll do it. We'll
get
there.
That's interesting.
Because I can spend a lot of time trying to like understand the numbers and just think, okay, if this happens, then we're totally screwed. So maybe we shouldn't do it. But Viv can sort of look at things more holistically and go with a bit of a more of a gut feel.
Yeah, I think we just have a huge amount of respect for each other. And at the end of the day, you know, I guess that's a partnership. You just got to learn how to work with each other.
And you have this complete trust in each other.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so much trust for it, working together. And I think that really helps build, you know, a good working relationship. And we both know that we want the best for the business, but also best for each other. Mm. And it's nice to, you know, to have a partner that cares about you so personally.
Yeah. Well, looking ahead, do you both have the same vision?
Yeah. By and large, yeah. We have it pretty set. I guess there's like some things on the side where there'll be some like pet project that I'm kind of keen on. And there's like, not sure about that. But like overall, yeah.
Yeah. What is that vision then?
I would just really like Little Moons to be an enduring, iconic brand.
Yeah, we have a vision of just sort of leaving Little Moons as a place, a company that we can be most proud of. And that means the way we treat our team, the way we interact with the community, the way we give back, just is something that we're proud of. And it's a journey that we want to build on. Like, that's what I'm quite excited, because like the last few years have been very much about getting the product out the door, meeting demand. And now we have the time to really focus on working on the business and just bringing it more international, really.
Okay. And you see yourselves both very much with the business. You don't see yourselves exiting and going and doing something completely different?
Not in the foreseeable future, no.
No, yeah, same.
What advice would you give to other founders who are just embarking on, just starting their businesses?
I would say make sure that it's something you're really passionate about, because it will be all-consuming. So it's got to be something you enjoy, and of course, problem-solving. Like, you've got to be good at problem-solving, because ultimately that's what a business does. It solves a problem for a consumer, and then within the business, you've got to solve a multitude of problems every day.
It's the key things, like really investing in your team and hiring the best people you can and making sure you're, you know, keeping them motivated. And then also just like looking after yourself, because it can feel like a sprint when you're an entrepreneur, but actually it's always turns out to be a bit of a marathon. And if you don't sort of take care of yourself, I've seen burnout happen so many times. And I think that's something that like you don't often focus on when you're starting a business, but it is important to think like that.
I like Adriana Huffington's advice: sleep your way to the top. And she meant sleep and take care of yourself, because you are the business, and by sleeping you're investing in your business. because then you turn up, you know, your full self in health, ready to fight that day. So yeah, sleep your way to the top.
Howard and Vivian Wong, so lovely to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.